the show is Stand to Reason, friends. Greg Kokel, that's me, your host, joining you for an hour today to talk about the most important things that we can discuss, ethics, values, and religion. And on those important things, we want to get the answers right. And so we're bringing careful thinking to the process. That's why I say I try to give you a piece of my mind. And if you want to call in, you're welcome to do so. And you give me a piece of yours on anything that's on your mind and in those areas. The number 855-243-9975. That's 855-243-9975. If you want the international number, 562 is the local area code, so you got to dial the international number. I think it's number one for U.S. 562-424-8229. In both cases, you get the wonderful Amy Hall, and she'll chat with you a moment and then put you on board. You'll wait it out for me. Sometimes it's a longish wait. Aunt Sarah in Tennessee has been on for over half an hour. She's so gracious. She's waiting it out while I have some opening remarks here at the top of the hour. A couple of weeks ago, we had our reality in Minneapolis, and one of the ways that I led out, and I talked about this last week, as I launched the event on Friday night, I said that Christianity is the best explanation for the way things are. And I was making the case that the Christian worldview, particularly the theistic worldview, and a Christian is a refinement of that, but broadly the Christian theistic worldview has tremendous explanatory power and does a better job at explaining the things that need explaining. All right. So what I did, what I'd like to do this time is just give you a little summary of what some of those things are that a worldview needs to explain. And in particular, since I received a challenge like this recently, why a materialistic worldview, that is a worldview that holds that the only thing that exists are matter in motion, okay? That's the metaphysics of it. You have physical things being pushed and pulled around by natural law, all right? That's materialism. It's meat all the way down, so to speak. There is no God. There are no angels. There are no miracles. There are no souls. There's no afterlife. None of that stuff is out there because none of that stuff is physical, and physical things are all there are. And the view goes, or the challenge has been offered different times, that is a better explanation for the way things are. So what I'd like to do is just lay out a couple of things that are meant to contrast the two, and you could decide for yourself, okay, which one is a, and my wording is chosen carefully, his, is a better explanation for the way things are. What we're not talking about here is possibilities. It's not going to be adequate to think up some kind of crazy idea and that's utterly implausible, but may in some people's mind be possible, because we're not talking about possibility or even plausibility, but what is most probably the case because it's the best explanation for the way things are, okay? And the competitors in this case are Christian theism and materialism. So the first thing you have to figure out is how are the things, what are the things that need explaining by either of these worldviews? And it strikes me that if I were to ask you, what is the most salient feature of reality, the thing that's most obvious about the world that needs explaining? Most of you wouldn't think about it because it's too obvious. But some have thought about it. And that is simply that there is a reality that needs explaining. That there is a reality. Why is something here rather than nothing here? Now, that seems to be a legitimate question. Philosopher Leibniz raised the question. And we can actually engage that, even if we don't know all the philosophy behind it or the way he carefully characterized his argument, by just simply reflecting that there is on the fact that there is something here and it hasn't always been here. It is the belief of the rank and file who think about these things, with almost without exception, that the universe has not always been here. Now, it's not. I'm not just counting heads. There are very good reasons, both scientific and metaphysical, to hold that's the case. But simply put, we pretty much all agree that everything that is here hasn't always been here. So the question is, what is the best explanation for it being here? Or to put it in other terms, what banged the Big Bang? Now, I know that some Christians are not comfortable with Big Bang cosmology. That doesn't matter here, because whatever you want to call it, what we are talking about is an ultimate beginning. And whether you're a Christian or not, virtually everyone believes in an ultimate beginning, regardless of what you call it. So my question then is, what caused the ultimate beginning? And here we are left with only two options. So we're going to radically simplify it for you. Either something or no thing, right? Either something caused the universe to come into being, or no thing caused the universe to come into being. That is, it was uncaused and just materialized like that for no reason and subsequently for no purpose, all right? Now, those are the only two options. And the reason that I say, I don't say something or no or nothing, I say some thing, two words, or no thing, two words. The reason I say it that way is if you talk about something, the universe coming from nothing, many people are willing to acknowledge, even scientists, that something came from nothing, but when you look closely at their nothing, it turns out to be not nothing, but some thing that is involved in the universe coming into the form that it is now, maybe the laws of gravity or something like that. But ultimately, even before that, you have to get back to a primitive singularity, a beginning of everything. So here's the question. Given that there is a world that came into existence sometime in the distant past, what is the best explanation for that? That no thing caused it, or that some thing caused it? Now, you might want to opt for the first, that no thing caused it, and you are welcome to do so. But let's be fair, it's not the odds-on favorite. Because where in the world, in our ordinary lives, do we have clear examples of uncaused effects? We don't. None. Every time there's something happening, there is something else that caused it to happen. Now, some people might want to retreat into the subatomic world and talk about quantum things, but let's be fair. Most people don't understand that, even people who teach on it, and they know that. And just because something appears to be uncaused doesn't mean it is uncaused, all right? So I'm going with the odds-on favorite, that something outside of the natural universe that would necessarily have to be smart and have to be powerful and would have to be personal, because only agents, persons, initiate causal chains, if I can use the philosophic way of putting it, not events themselves. A series of events don't start themselves. Someone has to hit the first domino before all the other dominoes can fall. And so when you use common sense and you ask about what's the best explanation for that things are, turns out that someone who is powerful and intelligent and outside of the natural system is responsible for that. And if you want to go for nothing, you're welcome to it, but it ain't the odds-on favorite, right? Okay, that's the first thing that needs to be explained. What's the next thing that needs to be explained? Well, this world that we're talking about that came into existence somehow, probably by someone, that would be God, is not a mess in one sense. It is a mess in another sense. We'll get to that in a moment. But one sense, it's not a mess. It is ordered. It is organized. Now, this is something that the atheists do not deny. You can describe it in different ways. The fine-tuned constants of the universe is a sophisticated way of talking about it. The wonderful book, A Privileged Planet, by Jay Richards and Guillermo Gonzalez, makes this point very handily, and many other things that have been written since then. The most famous atheist in the world, Richard Dawkins, says regarding the biological realm, for one, in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, starts out his book with these words, something akin to this. The biological realm is a complex world that gives the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Now, he doesn't believe it's designed for a purpose. He doesn't think it's designed at all, and he doesn't believe in any purpose because he's an atheist, and he thinks that the blind watchmaker of natural selection working on mutations is adequate to account for the complexity of the biological realm. Now, that's a contestable fact, or claim, I should say, and that's another discussion. But what I want you to notice is that even the famous atheist Richard Dawkins acknowledges that at least the biological realm looks like it's designed. Okay? And at another time, talking about the fine-tuned constants of the universe, which he's well aware of, says that, yeah, that's amazing. We really got lucky. So it's not just any old thing, but a very complex order that requires a very high degree of luck to accomplish, according to Richard Dawkins. But you don't need Richard Dawkins to tell you this because virtually everybody is aware intuitively that the universe is designed, and they talk about it with some regularity. And what they do is they look at the order of the universe, and they do not give credit necessarily to Father God, but rather to, yeah, you got it, Mother. Man, isn't Mother Nature amazing? Look at the miracle of Mother Nature. Oh, man, I can't believe what Mother Nature is able to accomplish all by herself. Now, do you see that what's being expressed when people use language like that is an intuition? What Doug X calls the design intuition. In other words, we have the ability that something is such that it takes know-how to make it the way it is. And so there is a design intuition that comes to play here. Now, if we don't like the idea of God, well, then we're just going to modify that and just talk about Mom, not Dad. Mother Nature, not Father God, but notice how there's an acknowledgement there. Now, here's the question. What is the best explanation? Is it Mother Nature, who's not a mother, and everything happened by accident, we just got lucky, Richard Dawkins? Or does the universe look designed because it is designed? Not just the biological realm, but also the entire universe, because it was designed for a purpose. Now, I know that there's an alternate explanation, and the alternate explanation is the multiverse. The multiverse is a proposition that our universe is not the only universe there is, and therefore the unbelievably and there's all kinds of examples I can give, but I'm just saying, you know, the chances of any of these, not just the basic laws of nature and the way they're fine-tuned and balanced, but any even just a simple molecule, a amino acid chain to fall in the precise order it must fall in order to do the work it needs to do in a cell, in which there are bazillions of other amino acids that have to be formulated in the same way. The chances are just, well, they're beyond astronomical. Astronomical means like universal or in the universe. So you think of the big universe. No, it's beyond it. It's like finding one electron in the whole universe with an X on it. That's just one way of determining one amino acid kind of deal. It's just crazy. And we have all of these other things that are also so unbelievably improbable. Now, of course, that problem can be solved, can't it? Because if we're not the only universe, and there is an infinite number of universes that are randomly generated and have random order, that with an infinite number, then we're going to have an infinite number of combinations, which is every possible combination imaginable. And we just happen to be living in the universe where it worked. It all fell together in a certain way, and now we're able to reflect on the improbability of our own existence. That's the argument. Here's the problem. The problem is there is no empirical evidence at all for other universes. There's some mathematical evidence about the possibility of such a thing, but there is no empirical evidence that it's an actuality. All right? And not only that, it creates another problem, and I just became aware of this recently. So I was listening to William Lane Craig's broadcast, Reasonable Faith. He talked about this. I'd never heard this before, but it stuck with me. If every possible universe is probable, given the multiverse hypothesis, and that means even the most unlikely circumstances are going to be actualized as a matter of fact, then it's not just our universe that with its finely tuned constants, etc., that is going to be actualized by accident, but any unlikely event in our universe is going to be equally certain given the multiverse theory. What am I talking about? So let's just say you go to Las Vegas and you say, I'm putting my bet on double aught on the roulette wheel. And sure enough, boom, you hit double aught. Now, the chances of that are not very high, but it does happen. And you say, let it ride, another double aught. And boom, it hits double aught again. Now, the chances of that are a lot. The chances against that are a lot higher, but it certainly could happen. You say, let it ride. Then you do that for 1,000 times. And every single time it hits double aught. What are the people watching going to do? They're going to think that the game is what? Rigged. Because this is radically improbable. And here's how you can answer them. It's not rigged at all. Because the fact is there is an infinite number of universes, a multiverse ensemble. And because there's an infinite number, there's always going to be some universe in which all of the particulars of this universe exist to establish and make possible intelligent life. And somebody named Greg Kokel, who's playing roulette, who hits double aught 1,000 times in a row. You see, the multiverse alternative means that no event, none, will be improbable in that universe. In fact, there will be an infinite number of universes on this view where that particular thing happens. Now, does that strike you as implausible? Do you think you're within your rights to think that 1,000 times, double aught, forget about 1,000 times, 10 times in a row, double aught, the game is rigged? Yeah, you're within your rights, which means the game is rigged. And which means the universe is rigged. And we know who rigged it. It was God. He made it this way. So what's the best explanation? Is it the multiverse or is it God? I think that the world is ordered in the way it is, that the best explanation for that is actually God. And one final thing here that I'll mention because of time here, that not only do we have a world that exists and that a world that is ordered, and each of these beg for an explanation of which the Christian can give a plausible, thoughtful, and commonsensible explanation. We also know that this world that is ordered is also broken. This essentially is the problem of evil. Now, how does the atheist explain a broken world? And my answer is he cannot, not a materialism. And the reason is the brokenness that we are talking about is a moral brokenness. Something is wrong with the world. The world is not the way it's supposed to be. It doesn't matter where you live or when you lived. We all know that something is wrong with the world. And by the way, I won't go into detail on this, but we all know that the thing that's wrong with the world is also something that's wrong with us. We contribute to what's wrong with the world. We're part of the problem. That's the existential concern, and I talked about this a little bit last week. But just looking at the world is broken. There can't be a way the world is not supposed to be unless there is a way the world is supposed to be. And there cannot be a way the world is supposed to be unless there's a sposer. So what this means is that the problem of evil turns out not to be a good argument against God, but a good argument for God. Because there can't be evil unless there are broken laws that are objective in nature. If the problem of evil is objective and not just a way that we describe things we don't like. And in order for there to be objective laws that are broken in order to have an objective problem of evil, there's got to be an objective lawmaker. When I say objective, I mean out there in the world. It's not just something inside I believe or feel because maybe my genes that were evolved a certain way caused me to feel this way. No, I'm not talking about what's inside. I'm talking about what's outside because that's the nature of the complaint. What's outside. That needs explaining. And materialism cannot explain it because there is no place for that kind of thing in the worldview itself. It does not fit because the worldview is materialistic in its take on what is real. And morality is not physical. It doesn't extend in space. It doesn't have weight. It doesn't respond to the laws of physics and chemistry. It is something outside of the physical realm. There is good. There is the evacuation of good or the corruption of good, which is evil. And this is what we experience and complain about when we shake our fist at God and say, "How could you allow such a thing?" I understand that. I'm sympathetic to it. But notice what has to be in place for us to make the complaint. There's got to be real evil, and then there's got to be really good as a departure from evil, and there's got to be a grounding for the really good. And none of this that we're talking about is physical. So therefore, the materialist can't even speak to the most or one of the most salient details of the universe as it is, so it cannot be the best explanation for the way things are. Now, that doesn't solve the problem of evil, of course, and theists have more to say about it. But notice that it is a powerful indicator, evidence of the existence of a moral lawmaker that grounds morality that makes possible something like evil to begin with. All right? So the world is. The world is ordered, and the world is broken. All three of those things are obvious to the casual observer, and for each one of those things, it is the theistic explanation that is the best explanation for the way things are, not the materialistic explanation. All right? I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. We'll take a break and come back after this.
As a high school teacher, I always had a red pen close at hand. When I wasn't in front of my students teaching a lesson, you could find me assessing assignments, grading essays, and evaluating exams. The red pen played a crucial role in the educational development of my students. With it, I questioned their assumptions, exposed their errors, and challenged them to think critically. You see, a good teacher doesn't merely tell his students that they're wrong. A good teacher shows his students why they're wrong so they don't make the same mistakes twice. He corrects because he cares. Last year, I was scrolling through social media, and frankly, I was discouraged at all the bad thinking that undergirded much of what I was reading. Then it hit me. What if someone applied the red pen to this flawed thinking? And Red Pen Logic with Mr. B was born. In the last few months, Red Pen Logic has grown in popularity. Through our engaging and shareable educational graphics and videos, we are helping people, especially young people, assess bad thinking by using good thinking. And we have a lot of fun in the process. So here's your homework assignment. Like the Red Pen Logic Facebook page so you don't miss our next graphic. And subscribe at the Red Pen Logic YouTube channel so you don't miss a single video. Class dismissed.
Friends, if you like this broadcast, I know you'll love hashtag STRask. It's our shorter 20-minute podcast where I am paired with the wonderful Amy Hall, and together we answer the questions you send us on Twitter. Hashtag STRask is released twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, and it's only about 20 minutes long, so it's perfect to listen to on your morning jog or while driving around running errands or cleaning your garage or just plain loafing at home. Amy and I tackle your questions on theology and ethics and culture and lots more, offering our insight on the questions you're asking or the challenges you face. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your own shows. Just remember, send us your questions on Twitter using the name of the podcast, hashtag STRask. That's hashtag STRask. Just a reminder that we are looking for somebody to join our team here at Stand to Reason. We need a social media coordinator, and they are going to be responsible for planning and implementing and monitoring Stand to Reason's content and also our social media channels. Now, this isn't something I know much about. That's why I'm really glad that we've had good people in the past to manage this, but we've had a shift in our staff, and so we're looking for someone to take on that job. We want somebody who's got a couple of years in that field. They know what they're doing. We want somebody, especially that's younger. I don't know if that's legal to ask for, but did I just break the law? Okay. So because we're trying to really draw in a whole new demographic. We want people who understand the culture and understand, have a feel, a heart for the heartbeat of Stand to Reason. So let's see what else. Oh, got to live in Southern California. Really important for that one too. All right. More information you can find by applying at str.org/hiring. str.org/hiring. All the details are there. All right. All right, now to Sarah in Tennessee, who has been so completely faithful and patient waiting for us. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Nice to hear from you. We've talked before, haven't we?
We have a couple weeks ago.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Good. Glad to have you back.
So, thank you. So I have a question about, I guess, the reliability and the trustworthiness of the Bible. I had a recent conversation with an atheist friend of mine who gave me his reasons of why he questions the reliability of the Bible. And so I wanted to run the one that I had most trouble with by you, which was the Council of Nicaea.
Which was the what? Can you say it again?
The Council of Nicaea. The Council of Nicaea.
The Council of Nicaea? Well, that's not even in the Bible.
Well, so I don't know too much about it, but he said that, you know, the Bible was altered here and altered in that council. And so that's one of the reasons he thinks that the Bible is not the way that it was intended to be.
I'm just having a little difficulty understanding. Was he saying that at the Council of Nicaea, something important about the Bible was changed?
Yes. And I don't know much about it, so I'm going to run it by you.
This is a very easy one to answer. This is the claim that Dan Brown makes in the I'm having a mental block with the name of the book that he wrote about 10 years ago. Now it was a big bestseller. I'll think of it in a minute. Or maybe Amy will put it up for me. But Da Vinci Code, there it is. Yeah. So Dan Brown wrote this book of fiction called The Da Vinci Code and made all kinds of claims about Christianity, early Christianity and the Bible in that book. And he claims that these claims in his book are all factual claims in which he builds a fictitious story around. But that's part of the fiction. He says that for example, the idea that Jesus was the Son of God was manufactured at the Council of Nicaea in 325. Now, we actually have the records of the Council of Nicaea. I have them in my bookshelf. It's in a book called The Creeds of Christendom by Philip Schaff, S-C-H-A-F-F, okay? And we know what happened there. We know who was there. We know what they debated on, and we know what the results were. There were like 318 bishops from all over, and the vote was 318-2. I guess that wouldn't be right. It would be 316-2 would be a total of 318. But the point is that we have so much detail about that event. We know what took place. There was nothing at that event that had any impact on changing the Bible itself. And I'll tell you why we know that this could not happen. Not only do we have the records there, but I want you to think about what the Bible is. The Bible is a book for us, but it is not really a book. It is a library of different books. This library didn't get bound together into a single volume until about the 3rd, 4th, or 5th centuries, in what is called a codex, C-O-D-E-X. So a codex is like what we call a book, ancient writings that were bound together in book-type form. But prior to that, these ancient writings circulated by themselves around the Mediterranean region. So whether it was the Gospel of John, or if it's the book of Paul to the Colossians, or whether it was the book of Hebrews or whatever, these are documents that are circulating. And they're documents that are being copied as they're being circulated so other people can have access to these valuable teachings. Are you with me so far?
Yes.
Okay. So by the 3rd century, 325, actually, the beginning of the 4th century, 325 AD, the documents that make up what we now call the Bible were circulating all over the Mediterranean region by that time. Okay? Now, I want you to think of a parallel circumstance. Where do you live in Tennessee, Sarah?
Nashville.
Okay, you live in Nashville. Do they have a newspaper in Nashville?
Yes, I do not read it.
you do not read it. Okay, well, whatever no. The newspaper in Nashville was, let's just say yesterday's edition was printed and delivered yesterday. Okay? And it goes out to all the newsstands. It goes out to those people who subscribe to it and who read it in their homes. Goes out to libraries, goes out to lots of different places, right?
Mm-hmm.
What if today, one day after yesterday's edition was delivered the way I just described, what if today I wanted to change that edition of the newspaper? How would I do that?
You have to get all the copies that were sent out, change them, and send them back out.
Exactly. And that is a superhuman effort, which can't be done. Okay. And now, but we're just talking about one day in the Nashville paper. But when we're talking about the Bible, we're talking about original documents that were written in different places and then copied and passed around. Now, this doesn't mean that everything in the Bible is true and that everything had been copied accurately. We're not addressing that issue. We're just addressing the claim that anyone hundreds of years after the autographs, that is, the originals, were written and began to be copied and passed around the Mediterranean region, could ever change those documents in any meaningful way. It is a physical impossibility. And by the way, when you read the documentation of what happened at the Council of Nicaea, you don't see all these details about how the Bible was changed at that time. There might have been copies of the Bible that were commissioned to be made. I mean, that might have been done by Constantine, who very, very loosely, well, he didn't oversee the Council of Nicaea. He called it. He convened it. But there were other principals that were provided the oversight. So, with regards to the first claim, I talk about this actually in the book Tactics, because there is a way of managing this once you realize the details of what the problems are, and that is asking exactly how did this take place, the Council of Nicaea. So where what were the records that you read that told you about this? That's one question. And how did this take place? The Bible was changed. Can you explain the process to me? Anything like that? What do you make of the fact that there were thousands and thousands of documents for a couple hundred years that have been circulated in the Mediterranean region that reflected the originals and could not possibly be retrieved to be changed? How do you overcome that obstacle? That would be questions I would ask the atheist. Make sense?
It does, yes. The other reason that he gave me, I haven't thought through well enough, so I'm going to run it by you. But he said the fact that we have different translations of the Bible throughout time, so NIV, ESV, all those, instead of one, that can lead to different meanings of the original scriptures.
Right.
He cited that also.
Well, that's true of any book that gets translated. Whether it's whether it's the Apostle Paul or Dostoevsky, for goodness sake, things that are written in original language and are translated to another language has to go through that process. All right, and there is arguably at least sometimes some nuances that are lost. However, does he think that the basic meaning of these passages are completely corrupted? This is a question you could ask him, simply because something's translated? I mean, I don't know what he'd say to that. He would have to say yes for his objection to stand, okay? But this is silly, because we have all kinds of books that are translated into lots of different languages. The Tactics is translated into Spanish. Story of Reality is translated into Polish. Relativism is translated into Romanian. Those are my books. Am I worried that they're going to pick up the relativism book in Romanian and really be reading Dostoevsky? No, they're going to be reading my stuff translated into their language, and it's going to capture probably 98% of my original meaning.
Gotcha.
I don't know why that's a problem, you know. There is something there, because there is something lost in translation, but not enough to make the kind of objection that he's offering, which would have to be the translation would have to efface the meaning of the original. And if you read, I have the New American Standard, I have the ESV, I have the NIV, I have the Living Bible, I have Good News for Modern Man. I've got lots of translations, and some are actually more free translations. They are not meant to be exact, and so like Living Bible type stuff, you know, but those don't count in the same category. But those other, King James, New King James, New International Version, ESV, NASB, I can have them all side by side. It could be like a polyglot, you know, they call it, when they have all these different translations side by side. And you're going to read the same thing. And every once in a while, you can see a little bit of nuance of difference. And you might scratch your head and say, gee, I wonder if that's it or the other one. And if you really care about it and it really matters, then you go and do the Greek yourself, in the case of the New Testament. But this is so far what this atheist has raised are frivolous. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be condescending, but these are frivolous objections.
The last one that he gave me, and I'll offer you what I thought about it, to see if you would agree. He said that the fact that different denominations within Christianity seem to focus more on either the Old Testament or the New Testament seems odd to him, so that, you know, if they're all written by God, God-inspired, and they were valuable, why do some Christians seem to emphasize one book over the other? And my response, what I thought of was, well, just because someone who claims to be a Christian values X doesn't mean that's what God values. And so that wouldn't be a claim on God's character, but maybe their erroneous decision, you know?
Of course. Of course. Look, there's a body of science, right? There's a field called science where we have, let's just stipulate reasonably reliable facts. And some people are biologists and some people are physicists, for goodness sake. I mean, the fact that some focus on one thing and not on the other doesn't undermine the discipline itself. And that sounds to me like the kind of answer that you gave to your friend. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's a great observation. I don't know why he would think. I can't believe. I mean, let me see if I understand his objection, because I'd want to get clear from him. It's kind of a Columbo number one. Okay, so what you're saying is you don't believe the Bible is inspired by God because there are some people who believe in the Bible who spend a lot of time in the Old Testament and not in the New Testament, and you find a bunch of people who spend a lot of time in the New Testament but not in the Old Testament, and therefore the Bible's not inspired by God. Did I read you right on that?
That's what it sounds like, or more so, you know, how there's the idea that because we have Jesus, we don't need the Old Testament. So if God, you know, inspired all these people to write in the Old Testament, why don't we value it anymore? That's kind of
well, I mean, that might be a fair question about the practice of certain Christians, but I don't see how it is in the slightest way a criticism on the trustworthiness or reliability of the Bible. You know, the Bible is 66 books long. Okay, last time I read through it from beginning to end, it took me like 3.5 years. I started in July, and I'm only on Exodus right now, right? So there's a lot of stuff there to read. That some people focus on one place rather than the other is just a matter of interest to them, and it might be good if Christians had a broader understanding of the entire account of God's word, but that's a liability of Christians. It's not a liability of God's word. And I don't know why he would take it as such either.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Huh. So is that the only, I mean, is that the only complaint he has?
I just really just surprised me. Yeah, those are the three he gave me when we had the conversation. He talked about a lot of other things. He gave me a lot of objections he had, and I was kind of really dazed. He threw a lot at me, so I thought I'd just tackle one with this call. But
I'm glad you're in conversation with him, and I hope you stay in conversation with him. I hope that some of the things I've said will be helpful to him. I think it would be a good idea if he just spent some time reading the New Testament himself to get an idea of what exactly is going on there. And there's nothing wrong with him asking the questions, but when he makes these claims that are just completely unfounded with regards to the facts of the matter, I call this tactic just the facts, ma'am. He's got the Council of Nicaea wrong. He misunderstands how the nature of the transmission of the documents of the New Testament took place. He doesn't realize that the Bible as a book didn't even occur until like 3rd or 4th century, you know, before it was just there a bunch of parchments traveling around. And we have copies of the whole Bible, but it is Sinaiticus, Vaticanus, Alexandrinus are the three famous copies of the Bible, codices, but all the rest of them are kind of bits and pieces because that's the way they were floating around the Mediterranean world at the time, in bits and pieces. All right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I hope that helps, and give us a call next time you, you encounter more challenges from your atheist friend, all right?
Yes, it did help. Thank you very much.
Yeah, have a great Thanksgiving. All right, Sarah?
Yeah, you too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye now. Well, that was I'm just going to take that as a good kind of final call here. We're going to abbreviate this particular hour a little bit. Nobody else on board, and I've said my deal about Thanksgiving. I did it in the first show, and then I got a chance to talk about worldviews here. What's the best explanation of the way things are? And nobody else waiting online here, so I'm just going to let you guys go and And I hope that you do make it a habit to give thanks to God, not just on Thanksgiving, which you'll be listening to this afterwards, but every single day of the year. Okay? Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye now.